everybody, and welcome to episode 37 of the Mental Dive Podcast, where we talk anything and everything, sports psychology and mental performance. I'm your host, Taylor Staden. I am so excited to drop this episode for everyone today with a good buddy of mine, Joe Carbone. Joe is a recent graduate from Springfield College's athletic counseling program, and me and Joe originally met a couple years ago at ASP in Toronto. And so at the beginning of COVID, I'm not sure if I messaged him or he messaged me, but we reconnected. And what was supposed to just be one Zoom call to kind of catch up ended up being more of a weekly Zoom call. And we would just bounce ideas off each other and we would learn from each other. And really what evolved from it was not only kind of like a peer consultation, but also a friendship. So throughout the course of the podcast, Joe is going to fill all you in on, you know, what he's been up to. We get into a bit of imagery, we get into mindfulness, and overall, we just have a very fun conversation. The way our weekly calls usually shake out is we go off on a lot of tangents, a lot of laughs, a lot of fun, but today we tried to limit the tangents. So before I go off on a tangent right now, let's get into the podcast. Joe Carbone, everybody. You know, Joe, a lot of people say that great things take a long time. So I would just like to say that after months of asking you to come on my podcast, I finally managed to get the Mental Joe, Joe Carbone, on the podcast. How you doing today, buddy? You good?
I'm doing well. And to be fair, I have been saying for about a month that whenever you need me on the pod, I would come on the pod.
I think that's a bit of a stretch. I think it's been like 2 weeks. I don't know. A month's a bit of a stretch.
It was July 4th weekend. It was July 4th weekend, I told you. I would come on the pod.
Oh, you know what? No, you're right. Because I remember, yeah. No, okay, yeah. I'll give you that one. Fair enough, man. So what have you been up to lately? I know you've been telling me you've been doing some camp stuff. Recently announced you're going back to West Point. Like, just give us some updates. How you been, man?
So I've been well. I've been fortunate enough that based on where I live in New York, COVID was causing a lot of issues here. Mm-hmm. But after that, it's really been handled well here in New York. And because of that, we were able to open up a lot of sport camps. So through a couple of people that I know, I was able to get an opportunity to work originally as a coach, but now transitioning more to a mental skills role with a club near me and doing brief mental skills interventions for youth soccer players that normally wouldn't have access to sports psychology services. They really enjoyed it, and I have a week off from that this week, and I have one more week coming up. But that's been a ton of fun. And as you mentioned, I was able to be fortunate enough to have the luck to get into West Point again and working back at the U.S. Military Academy.
Right on.
So I spent the beginning of the spring semester there, and obviously COVID happened around March, and that kind of put things on hold. Mm-hmm. So I was able to come back and help them transition to their new intern group.
You know, we met back as 2018, great time. Right off the bat, I knew this guy is passionate about sports psych. I remember it very clearly. We're at the Rec Room in Toronto. Yankees are on. So you got like one eye on the 10 screens of the Rec Room. You got one eye kind of on me. You're like, you're telling me about some like theory that, cause I'm only in my second year of my undergrad. I didn't know much. Right. So you're ripping some like major theories off of me. Like I'm kind of lost as it is. You're looking over, you're like, oh, so it was hilarious. In saying that, you know, kind of fueling your passion, getting to where you are and, you know, why you enjoy what you do so much. How did this all start? You know, what made you want to study sports psychology?
So I remember exactly where we were standing in the Rec Room. I could probably put us right back there in the exact angle because I was able to watch with my right eye, watch over your shoulder at what MLB playoff game was going on or the two that were going on those monster screen, while the rest of your Canadian brethren were watching NHL games, the whatever two NHL games are on those TVs. But to answer your question, so I guess I always enjoyed the mental side of sports and the relational side of everything. I was always that person growing up who was the one who was turned to by a lot of friends, and that didn't stop when I really got involved in sport heavily. So for me, I'm from New York, as I mentioned. I grew up a Yankee fan. So with being a Yankees fan in the early 2010s, late 2000s, you kind of got a lot of players who were signed to big contracts and then never performed in New York. And there was always this question of why can some do it and why can't some? Because they would then leave 3, 4, 5 years later and perform just as well as they were when they got there. And that's when I started to realize that pressure and the environment really caused a lot of players' problems. I was also a catcher in baseball, which is my main sport. And my best friend growing up was one of our top pitchers in my town. And he, for no good reason, or at least it seemed that way back when we were growing up, when we were 13, 14, 15 years old, could not pitch wearing my school's uniform. We'd go play travel ball. He'd go play in tournament ball. Lights out. But it was something about playing for my school really stressed him out. And for his first 3 years, no college would have looked at him. And then we got to our senior year and he just, some switch flipped and he was able to perform. And by that point, I realized sports psychology was this thing I really wanted to do. I discovered the field through research. So I was really fortunate when I was going through my high school years and looking at colleges, because I'd realized I wanted to do sports psychology as a career back then, that I was able to meet and speak to college professors and graduate programs like Dr. Greg Shelley up at Ithaca College, who I was fortunate enough to get 15, 20 minutes of his time as a junior in high school. And he really was a huge influence guiding me to where I could go. Dr. Bruce Klonsky at SUNY Fredonia out near Buffalo has been an awesome person to speak to and become a very good friend of mine for research that we may or may not get to talk about later on. And then the people who really guided my decision and my reasoning to go to West Virginia with the Dean Emeritus of College of Physical Activity and Sports Sciences at West Virginia University, Dr. Dan Brooks, as well as Dr. Sam Zizzi, who really did a good job of convincing me that West Virginia was the place for me to go. So graduated my high school in New York, spent 4 years studying sports psychology, sociology, and coaching at West Virginia University. Mm-hmm. For 3 of those years, I was a student manager doing operations and video work with the WVU baseball team. Got to go to the first regional since the year I was born, which is a very fun
time.
There you go. And then following that, I followed a good friend of mine, Nathan, to Springfield College. So I came a little closer to home. And at Springfield College, I had some of the best experiences I could have asked for. Under Dr. Judy Vernault and Dr. Britt Brewer, among others, I did all my supervision hours, got to do upwards of 900 hours of direct work with clients.
Wow.
And it was one of the best experiences I could have ever asked for. And Springfield College has given me so much, and so has West Virginia University. So I finished up in May, and that is a very long-winded version of what got me to where I am now.
Love that, man. And you know what? It sounds like Springfield College is being one of those very applied masters out there where you just get a lot of hands-on experience, get a really crack down on the CNPC, hours and whatnot. So it sounds like you've had a lot of time to maybe try out a lot of different mental skills and interventions and whatnot. And one of them that I find, because, you know, when we had our weekly kind of calls throughout COVID, you seem to talk quite a bit about imagery. So how about we get a little bit into imagery and why you find it such an essential mental skill?
So for me, and you're right, we've talked plenty about imagery. For me, I just think imagery is one of these skills that can be used in so many ways and can be done in really any environment. You can plug in your headphones and you could just get lost in a script or just in music to block everything out. And whether you're going to calm yourself down, you're trying to amp yourself up, you're trying to practice reps for something you can't replicate in games, or if you just want to go over a situation and practice, almost using it like it's scout tape or practice footage. For me, I just think it's this very basic skill for athletes of any age to understand. Whether you're working with really young kids whose imaginations run wild, and they can get it. To older kids, to adults who, when you explain to them the reasoning for it and you explain to them psychoneuromuscular theory and how our brain can influence the movement of our muscles even when we consciously tell them not to move. It works. It makes sense. And for me, it's just a foundational skill that I can relate a lot of things back to. And older athletes, I always talk about the Michael Phelps story I heard years ago, where when he was training for the Olympics, he would go through and visualize what would happen when he was in the middle of a race and one of his goggles would fill with water. Now, I'm not a swimmer. I was fortunate enough to study alongside a number of high-level swimmers who said that is the worst thing that could happen.
Okay.
That's something you can't train for. And when you're in the middle of a long race, that can distract you and take you off your mind, take you off your pace. So to prepare for that and what they would do in that situation, you can't practice that really. You can't practice something random like that happening. So that was just an example of something I always like to work with my athletes on. Prepare for the things that you can't practice for.
Mm-hmm. For sure. And I mean, in that sense too, like one thing that I kind of like to do when I do goal setting and whatnot with athletes is I say, okay, I want you to think of potential adversities that might happen with your performance. Just like you're talking about with imagery where, you know, if your goggle fills up, well, how are you going to respond? And I think that's really important too, because we always talk about the things, how we're going to respond if we win. Like, you know, we want to do imagery. Think about what's going to happen when you win. But at the same time, we also want to think about what's going to happen if, you know, you're like, if you're swimming, your goggle fills up with water or you miss the net, you know, 3-4 times, you know, whatever sport you're playing. So I think using imagery very kind of diversely in that sense to not only imagine what you want to happen, but also how you're going to respond when what you don't want is going to happen.
Exactly. And for me, that's the biggest benefit to imagery. I think of almost every other mental skill.
Mm-hmm.
For imagery, you can plan for things that may or may not happen. For other mental skills, sometimes you have to rehearse them, and you can use imagery to rehearse other mental skills.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a baseball player, and if you're a pitcher, for instance, you get a bad call from a pitcher, from an umpire, you can walk yourself through all a different routine, a post-pitch routine or a pre-pitch routine to refocus yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You can use one mental skill to practice another.
Mm-hmm.
And it gives you this opportunity to work yourself through routines, through negative situations that are so common in sport. And it might be a bias because my sport is a 70% failure rate. And you go to
the yeah, the good players are 70%.
That's the best season ever. The guy failed something like 56% of the time.
Wow.
And he hit 440 or 460. I can't remember the number off the top of my head.
How many at-bats did you have?
I mean, that was a full season. That was Rogers Hornsby. I believe it was Rogers Hornsby, and I believe it was somewhere in the 430s, 440s. Yeah, I'll look that up after the podcast, and I'll tell you. Very, very high number. It was almost 100 years ago, to give you a different time. But through a grind of a season, it's easy to kind of do those things to stay sharp.
Mm-hmm.
And especially when you're in a situation now in pro baseball, where you had the St. Louis Cardinals who didn't play for almost 3 weeks. And mm-hmm. you can use things like imagery to keep yourself sharp. Put yourself in a situation on a bullpen day to work through your routines at whatever speed you want to go through. And for me, I enjoy it that way. I also enjoy teaching it as the first mental skill for a lot of kids, because it's very, when I'm working with people who've never done sports psychology before, it's a very approachable, very feelable skill. And I've shown you the demonstration, and because most of your listeners probably won't see this, I won't do the demo specifically, but I have a progression I do when I teach imagery.
Mm-hmm.
Where I have a demonstration I use that really puts into light psychoneuromuscular theory, meaning your thoughts influence your muscles through the process of your neurons firing. Explaining that to older kids, not explaining it to younger ones because they don't need to fully understand it. But then working through a relaxation script that's very polysensory. Talking about a beach or a bonfire, really my two go-to scripts,
mm-hmm.
because you can tell them, feel the heat of the skin, the sun on your skin, or feel the warmth of the fire on you, the feeling of your feet walking into sand or walking into the water. Very unmistakable sensations that most people have either experienced recently or have done at some point in their lives, or have an idea of what that might feel like. And for me, once they have those feelings and I debrief that relaxation script and say, what were your most vivid sensations? And they're telling me all different things. Stuff starts, you can watch stuff start to click and go, oh, this is why this makes sense. And then you transition to sports setting and then just think, and it clicks for people.
Yeah, for sure, man. And I mean, you know what? You do know, as you see my page, I do like to make clips. So if you want to show us quickly the strategy that you taught me that I use actually quite a bit with the athletes I work with, by all means.
I can't take credit for coming up with this. So I first learned this from a really good friend of mine who, ironically enough, actually was just talking to me earlier in the day about activities to do through Zoom for Zoom workshops, because, you know, it's still a thing. So what we do is we take a piece of string, and you can use things like a pen cap, or what I use, because I have about 1,800 of these, it feels like, laying around my house, you have a washer. On a piece of string, you tie it up. And the idea, as Taylor is doing, or you can use headphones, but you want to use headphones that are very soft with the string, very light and able to move, because you want it to be able to move. And you rest your elbow on either a table you can't see below me, or if we're outdoors, I'll have them rested on my knee, and I'll do that for everybody here. Drop it, and you have your athletes or your people that you're working with, dangle the string from their thumb. Pinch it like this, slack your wrist, steady it. And from there, you just have them picture the ring going in a circle, clockwise. And as you're doing this, you remind them not to move their hands.
I've done this like north of 10 times now, and it still freaks me out when I do it. I'm not gonna lie.
Oh yeah, it's crazy. And then once they get it moving, you have them stop it. But then you have them reverse it counterclockwise. And you have them go through this progression, counterclockwise stop, and then the hardest one, because it involves the most motor control I found, forward, back, left, right.
Forward, back,
because
left, right.
Because then you're not having to just spin forward, back, left, right, and have them stop in between each one. And I do this with my kids, and I watch them lose their mind when they start to get this happen.
Mm-hmm.
Jokingly, I was doing this right around when The Mandalorian was coming out. I'm like, no, you're not all Jedi. You're not Baby Yoda. And it's a very approachable thing. And I lead off this workshop. I lead off teaching imagery with that, because for me, I always like to do activities where I'm building a progression. I want to meet you at the lowest common denominator. Mm-hmm. Which is, let me get you a physical, tangible thing. If I walk into a room of 14, 18-year-olds, 18 to 24s, 24 to 30s or beyond, and I tell them, hey, picture that, just visualize this thing for me, and it's going to help your performance, trust me, and I don't have any cachet of a reason for trust, it's not going to work.
Yeah.
This helps me build rapport and build some level of being an expert in what I do.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of opens the door.
Yeah. And I think you kind of touched on it a bit there. What's so important too is you can go to a room and you can know, you can be the world's leading expert on imagery. Okay. Mm-hmm. But if you don't know how to relate to people, it's really, really hard for you to get through to them. So I think just having something that's, you're using basically this washer and the string or earphone, whatever you're using, to make something that's not very tangible. I think that's huge for just kind of establishing buy-in and building rapport with the group you're working with.
Exactly. And I know Brian mentioned this, Brian Miles, who is the mental performance coordinator, and I think he's now the Major League Sports Psych with the Indians. He talked about this, I believe, on your pod as well, because he talks about it every single time he speaks at any major conference. And it's the truth, is that the idea of meeting someone where they're at and trying to build the relationships before you're doing any work is a very counseling-based thing, and that's something that within the athletic counseling program that Dr. Judy Van Roll and Britt do an amazing job of imparting on us.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can't do anything until you know the group, until they know you. Or you can, but you're losing most of the group. This is all about that relationship building. And I believe Brian spoke about that for a little while with you on your pod. Jesse probably mentioned it at some point as well. because of West Virginia's DAC program being a part of counseling program as well. And that's just such a huge thing. I don't like going into settings where I'm just like one-offing because it's not going to be helpful. I've only done it once, and I was thankful that I had a really good friend who was the person who introduced me, and they trusted her, so they then trusted me because of that. Other than that, it's not a successful thing for practitioners. You probably experienced that yourself, Taylor. Of the first time you walk in, is almost never your best workshop.
Oh, it's tough. It can be tough.
The first time once they get comfortable with you, right?
Yeah. No, you're right for sure. I mean, I guess in a sense, he was kind of the name of the game, right? It's a process. Mm-hmm. Like we talk about athletes, with them getting better and then, with their skills and whatnot, it is a process. So it's the same kind of idea for us. And sorry, so I've been meaning to Google this or look this up for like months now, and it crosses my mind. It's a waste of my energy because I don't write it down, don't remind myself. But okay, I'm just going to see if you know the answer to this. All right.
Oh, God.
So some people will kind of use the word visualization and imagery synonymously in a sense sometimes, but they're different. They're not the same thing. So my kind of thoughts is there a time where visualization is actually a better exercise than imagery? Because my understanding is that imagery allows everything to be more vivid and more real, which should help with more positive transfer. But then at the same time, I think you hear a lot of people just talk about just visualizing something. So like, do you know, or like, should I just Google this after the podcast? Like, I'm not sure.
I think we should, once we stop recording this, this is going to be a much longer conversation than either of us intend. But the idea, when you say that, for me, to a conversation we had a couple of weeks ago about persistence versus resilience, or
perseverance versus resilience. Yeah.
Something similar to that, where I hear this all the time. I'll play FIFA, and they'll say, someone will mention visualizing success. And like, that's great. But for me, when I think of visualizing success, it's picturing yourself being somewhere versus imagery, which is growing upon that.
Mm-hmm.
Visualizing something, you're just kind of seeing.
Yeah.
And you're thinking about something. Whereas with imagery, by definition, it's polysensory.
Mm-hmm.
Multiple senses going on at the same time, all five senses.
Mm-hmm.
Which, for any of your listeners who aren't NPCs or who are and are, have athletes who struggle with any kind of anxiety, like stress or anxiety, using the five senses in a 5-4-3-2-1 is the greatest way I've ever found to ground athletes and ground people who are stressing out and who are starting to spiral with anxiety. Five things you see, four things you hear, three things you feel, two things you smell, one thing you taste. Immediately grounds you and puts you back in the moment. Because if you're focusing on those things, you can't be, your mind is coming back to the present without pushing everything away. But that's when you compare visualization and imagery, they're synonymous for me. They mean basically the same thing, at least to me, but I can see them being different for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because I was just thinking, we can go more in depth later, but it kept crossing my mind, and like, I needed an answer. So I guess we'll keep hashing that one out. But now, so you talk about earlier, just kind of about how imagery allows you to practice other mental skills. And so now you're talking about how you use the 5-4-3-2-1 to help bring athletes back to the present. So that obviously leads right into mindfulness. So Joe, I'm going to ask you, why do you think mindfulness is so important? And what are some practical strategies that you use with athletes to help them improve, on their ability to be mindful?
So for me, it comes back to the ACT model and the MAC model specifically in reference to mindfulness, because for the reasons of transparency, I'm not someone who has a 20 to 30 minute mindfulness practice every day.
Same.
That's just not who I am. And for most athletes and a lot of athletes, that's not really realistic. The angle I take for mindfulness is the idea of really using the ACT and the MAC model being something that was published in a book. I believe I'm blanking on the title of the book right now, but by Frank Gardner and Zella Moore. two fantastic, fantastic psychologists. And I both have Ben Taylor, the name of the book, so it can be in the link in the description of the podcast, because it's a fantastic read for anybody who wants to learn more about this. The idea from Jon Kabat-Zinn, his exact definition of mindfulness. Mindfulness is the awareness that arises through paying attention on purpose in the present moment, non-judgmentally. That is straight from his mouth. That is the simplest definition of mindfulness you can find. And the idea for me is paying attention on purpose in the present moment, non-judgmentally, is what we need to do in sport. Because you can't focus 100% or even 90% of your attention and your energy where it needs to go in sport. Right now I'm working with soccer players. There are 18 different things they could be focusing on at any given moment. And if you spiral out of control or your mind isn't present for 30 seconds, that's your game. I'm a PSG fan, so my biggest game I've seen in my life is in, at the time of recording this, something like 6 hours, 5 hours. And our semifinal game that I watched on TV with a heart pounding through my chest, two goals were scored in 4 minutes to flip a match. 30 seconds of that changes the entire game. Mm. Two players on that field not being where they needed to be in the moment for 30 seconds changes that match entirely. We don't do what we do, or PSG doesn't do what they need to do. Mm-hmm. Happens for, if you take a pitch off in baseball, if you take 30 seconds off of a 2 minute shift, Taylor, normally in hockey?
In hockey, 2 minutes is usually a pretty long shift. If you're going hard, 45 seconds, maybe a minute.
If you're gone for an entire, if you're out for half a shift, you're probably making a ton of mistakes. Mm-hmm. And the idea that I take when it comes to presence and mindfulness when I'm working with athletes is you're going to make a mistake. You're going to make multiple mistakes in a game. Mm-hmm. But how do you let those mistakes stand alone versus compound and snowball into 3, 4, 5 mistakes because you made a mistake that led to a fast break the other way, but then you didn't cover your person and your person scores. Mm-hmm. That's two mistakes at least. And now the first mistake, which didn't directly lead to a score, led to a second mistake that led to, you know, the opposing team scoring against you. Mm-hmm. And that's the angle I take with my athletes is things happen. Again, I would say bias of failure happens in sport. But it's mm-hmm. not about, and this is going to sound exactly like the Rocky quote, it's not about not about how many times you fail. It's about what happens afterwards. Do you stay mm-hmm. down? Do you wallow in it? Do you get a foul called on you in a soccer game that was questionable and you're out of it for the next 30 seconds and you make two more and you commit two more fouls and get yourself a yellow card? Mm-hmm. Or do you get right back to where you need to be, win the next ball, and give your team a good scoring chance? Mm-hmm. Or take down break down a scoring chance in soccer. Whatever other sports, insert metaphor there that's important. Because if you get lost, you're not there. And we all have slow internet right now, slower than it should be, because we don't have the bandwidth we should have. We need to keep our bandwidth and our focus narrower and narrower and narrower. Mm-hmm. I build on this when I was working with high school wrestlers. I did a lot of work with this where I hit this early. And then as the season went on and they were just all physically and mentally exhausted, I took this same language and saying, listen, we've got a narrower focus. And rather than pushing out the outside noise, trying to tell the monkey mind that's going to go, as the Buddhists call it, the monkey mind. They're trying to push that away and wasting energy pushing that away. Narrow to the present. Narrow on the guy or the girl that you're going up against in that moment. When you get tired, when you start to lose focus, bring yourself back and use what you have in those moments. Mm-hmm. And that was a really tangible thing for a lot of our guys, where it was, hey, we're going to have all these things going on. We're going to feel tired. But let's focus here. I got 2 minutes to go in this wrestling match. I'll worry about that later. Mm-hmm. I wish I could show it to you in person. I wish I was with you in person to show you something I learned at Aspen. It was the year before we met. I think it was 2017 Aspen.
Okay.
With but the guy from Virginia Tech was doing did a presentation. He showed me this great trick where you give them, shout out to Britt Brewer for the textbook here, but you have them hold a book in front of their face. You ask them what they can see, and they're going to say the book. But then what you do is you have them, if they're holding it, you put your hands on the book, the other side, and you have them try and push you away.
Oh, I see.
The idea is if you have two people, I've done this with a wall, the harder they push, you push back and you resist it. To illustrate the point that the harder they're going to try and push away pervasive thoughts, the harder they're going to stay. The idea of what resists persists.
Right.
And then what you do, if you're sitting down, it's really easy. You have them put it in your lap, in their lap, or put it in, on their desk in front of them. You say, now what can you see? Mm-hmm. Everything. But what's still in your lap or on the table? The textbook. The book or the clipboard being a metaphor for all of those thoughts that are going on in your head
right.
that you don't want being there.
Mm-hmm.
In baseball, I tell guys, put it in your back pocket. Because everybody who's ever played baseball or softball knows you have your back pocket for your batting gloves, your seats, whatever. Put those things in your back pocket. Amen to that. Put them in your back pocket. And for those of you who are listening, Taylor just held up a pair of Under Armour batting gloves.
I don't know why everything's so handy today.
That's definitely a leftover from camp. But you put it in your back pocket, and you can deal with it later. And that's my idea is, listen, if you put it there and you're not pushing it away. You're saying, I'm going to deal with this when I get into the dugout. After when I get out of the field, when I'm done with the game and I want to unpack these things. That's where I use the mindfulness to keep people grounded, and instead of wasting energy to push them away, keep them in the moment. And to not get pissed at themselves for leaving the moment.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
And you and I have had multiple conversations about this.
Yes, we have. We have. And I think one of the bigger things there too with you know, mindfulness and whatnot is like you said, the acceptance piece where you have to accept the fact that sports are full of mistakes. Like I believe it was Rob Schremp said recently, former NHL player, he was talking about how hockey is a continuous game of mistakes. You start the game, there's a face-off, someone wins, someone loses. And just snowballs. You have a pucks turnover, pucks go in the net, right? Like you make a bad pass. So it's a continuous game of mistakes. So if you're getting held up on your mistakes, then you're going to continuously be held up and not playing to your full potential. And I think even more so now that you're talking about it, I believe that giving them the tools to handle, you know, and manage those mistakes and those failures and their stress in mid-game is so important. You know, like one thing that I like to do with my athletes is I like to always give them a customized reset routine, right? So in that way, when they're in the game, they can, one, reflect on what happened so they can learn from it. Two, they can reset so they can use, you know, like I said, mindfulness, so breathing. You might use some progressive muscle relaxation. And then after that, use a visual, verbal, or auditory cue, which helps them lock back into the moment. So yeah, I think, you know, I don't want to go on a big resiliency tangent now. However, I believe that giving them the tools ahead of time, so then that way, you know, not only can they accept mistakes, but also give them the tools to be able to handle them, I think is so important.
And where you're going there is awesome, is exactly where I like to go, which is learn how to handle the mistakes in the moment. I'm not telling, one of the things that people often misconstrue about ACT and radical acceptance is, oh, you're just telling them that failure is okay. If you want to be an Olympic swimmer, if you want to be an Olympic athlete, you're going to have to learn how to fail less, but you're still going to have to manage what happens when you fail and how you grow from it. And the idea is not to be adverse to failure. It's a cliche pretty much in the sports cycle at this point, but failure, and Zach Brandon, who is an unbelievable professional in his field working with the Diamondbacks, talks about this all the time on his Twitter and on his LinkedIn, of failure isn't a bad thing. What happens is if you don't learn from it and you repeat the same thing over and over again, you're not getting better, you're getting worse. Mm. So making a mistake and identifying those mistakes and saying, okay, what do I need to do to make this mistake less often?
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it's learning how to decouple those two things, saying, okay, how do we handle the mistake now? And when do we address the, how do I get this better? Because saying, okay, I need to not do that. If I get called for if I get the ball taken from me as a, or the puck taken from me as a hockey player, you might know right away what you did wrong. But thinking about that for 15 to 20 seconds in that moment is not the time to do it.
Yeah, exactly.
But how much time between shifts normally?
Oh, depends how good you are. I mean, if you're me, you have quite a bit of time to reflect on the bench. What? But
5 minutes? 3 to 5 minutes probably on the bench?
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
You got a couple of minutes, 2 to 3 minutes to realize, okay, I need to not do this against this guy next time. Mm-hmm. And knowing the when and the where and the how to correct those mistakes is what I really like to get into with a lot of athletes. Mm-hmm. Something that actually I took from Reiner when you were talking with Reiner on your podcast.
Oh, yeah. Shout out to Reiner. Great guy.
Yeah. Is I was observing the club. So I worked with this club. I worked with their youth camps. I then went to one of their practices. And something that I'm going to do when I go later on today to their practice is actually time them when they're scrimmaging, mm-hmm. when they make a mistake to when they've left it behind.
Oh, the next play speed.
There were some athletes who were, I was watching a couple of them who just get frustrated and wound up. And 20 seconds later, 30 seconds later, were still kicking the grass or just kind of like this, like mm-hmm. when the ball went out of play. Talk and using those exact numbers, say, hey, listen, you're out of the game for 30 seconds. What could you have been doing with those 30 seconds that you weren't, where you were almost wasting, and teaching them to, and using that time there. Because Reiner, for those of you, if you haven't listened to that Reiner podcast, it's fantastic. But him talking about how he would watch games and track how long people were taking to make to get over mistakes, among other things. That's the one I remember sticking out to me a lot. You obviously can probably speak to more of what that podcast had. But going and doing that with your athletes, if you notice that that's an issue, giving them tangible numbers. Athletes are just wired to like numbers. You probably can speak to that as a hockey guy too.
Yeah, man, it's really easy to get caught up in your numbers. Mm-hmm. But yeah, no. And I mean, I really, really liked how you mentioned what Zach Brandon was talking about, where his kind of definition of failure, because I was walking my dog the other day and I threw on Dr. Cindy Campoff's podcast and she was interviewing Lauren Johnson. Excellent podcast. And
I got to listen to that one.
It's a good one. And Lauren Johnson, oh, Yankees guy, yeah. Lauren Johnson was talking about how, I'm paraphrasing a bit here, but it was kind of along the lines of like, failure is really when you don't do something, right?
Yes.
Like not acting, that's a bigger failure than, you tried something, it didn't work. Okay, well, you tried something, it didn't work. You know, like how are you going to learn from that? How are you going to move forward, right? As you know, a central part of the learning process is making mistakes. And I feel like that's one of the kind of reasons why so many people don't act, right? They're scared of making mistakes. They're not willing to go outside of their comfort zones. And I think this is something that, like, you know, I've had to work on myself. You know, we're all human. I'm sure you've done it as well. And just like, we have to understand that when we go outside of our comfort zone and when we're trying to really get better at something, it's not going to feel that great sometimes. And we're going to mm-hmm. be uncomfortable and we're going to want to quit. But we have to remind ourselves that as long as we're learning, you know, through proper self-reflection and whatnot and improving, that's where the success is, right? It's not going to happen overnight kind of thing. And I'm not going to go on this big motivational tangent, but more or less, that's kind of my thoughts here.
A thought that came into my mind as you're talking about that is it's the Michael Scott quote from The Office of where he misquotes Michael Jordan. It's like you miss 100% of the shots you don't take. But the thing is that just because you miss the idea there is the opposite. Economists talk about as an opportunity cost, where you're not the cost of using an opportunity. So if you don't take this chance, if in my case, I don't go on your podcast, there's all of these things that I'm missing out on, even if there's things that I can get better at as I hear this podcast back and critique myself, you lose those opportunities to get better. If you don't do something, but taking the opportunity is something I always say to my athletes. Don't, if you mess up, okay, especially in practice. I'll work with like 7-year-old kids on soccer skills and I'll say, and they'll beat themselves up over missing a goal. And I look at them like, what's the point of this drill? Is the point of this drill to be able to score on like a 6-foot-wide goal made of two long plastic poles? Or is the point of this drill to keep your shape and create an opportunity like you just had? And they're like, the points to create the opportunity. And they're like, oh, exactly. So don't, that's going to go in, that's going to find up a back of a regulation net for you. Mm-hmm. Focus on what you did right, not the end result of that. You're going to beat yourself up over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not worrying about things you can't control. Ultimately, you can't control if it hits an end or not. You can do a lot of things to influence where it goes. But ultimately, once that ball leaves your foot, you can't control it.
Or you can control, but learn, if you're going to get mad at yourself for it, learn, realize, okay, if you're bummed about missing that shot, okay, now what do I need to do to fix it? Do I need to square my hips up to the ball a little bit better to create a better angle? Mm-hmm. And that goes into a whole other diatribe that we had recently about confidence and sources of confidence beyond just self-efficacy theory of how do you evaluate yourself and how do you evaluate success and failure. Mm-hmm. In a drill, if you do everything that's supposed to happen in a drill and you just miss the goal, but that's not the point of the drill, that's not what makes you successful in the drill, you did everything right. Don't beat yourself over the one thing that's actually not important in the situation.
Mm-hmm.
That was another hour-long conversation that we had recently, in and of itself, at least hour-long, I think.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I was working with this hockey player once, and I was watching the game. I noticed he was getting a lot of opportunities. He was in the right spots, getting a lot of shots off, you know, doing all the right things, but they weren't going his way. They weren't going in. And I noticed his body language was kind of like, you know, negative and whatnot. And I just said to him, like, you know, who's your favorite hockey player? And he said, Austin Matthews, right? One of the best goal scorers in the world, pushing to be the best right now. And I said, okay. So, you know, Austin Matthews doesn't score on about 83% of the shots he takes. So if he shoots 100 pucks, yeah, best goal scorers in the NHL only score 15 to 20% of the time usually. So I said to him,
continue. I want to hear this now.
Yeah. So I said to him, like, you know, you look at Austin Matthews, you know, he has every 100 shots he takes in a game, he only scores roughly what, I haven't checked the stats, like 17% of them. David Pastrnak, Alex Ovechkin, all these elite goal scorers who you look up to and you idolize, you know, they don't score that often, right? But you know what makes them so great is that they understand that it's a process and they keep pushing. And it kind of cheered him up a bit. And you know what? I'm not taking credit for it, but he scored in the third period. So that's a little example I have. But I think it's so important just to, like, shift your focus on, you know, the controllable factors. Control the controllables in other sports, like, cliche. But
and we've had this conversation. And
yeah.
So one of the things I got to, opportunities that I got through Springfield was I was able to work in professional baseball with an independent team in what was the, or what used to be called the Can-Am League, the Canadian American League,
mm-hmm.
Independent Baseball League. And while I was working with this independent league team, I got really lucky and was in the dugout every day. And we had this one player who joined us about halfway through the season, short Japanese guy who could put his bat onto everything. So for your listeners who are baseball guys, think about an Ichiro style player who could slap anything anywhere they wanted to. There was one game vividly that I remember where a left-handed pitcher came in. It was a day game, the sixth inning of a game. Left-handed reliever comes out of the bullpen, and our guy was a left-handed hitter. And he got 2-2, 3-2 count, throws him an unbelievable slider. This pitch finishes probably 3 to 4 inches off the plate. And our guy takes the world's ugliest swing. You would not show this to your kids to emulate if you were a coach ever. Top hand, bottom hand only, lunges out to smack it or to slap it. It lands 3 feet behind the third baseman, goes for a double because this guy's fast. The pitcher and me, I'm cheering for our guy, but I'm watching the pitcher, and the pitcher is just angry and just disgusted with himself. Two pitches later, we have another left-handed hitter who was supposed to, this guy was supposed to be able to get out. Two pitches later, he hangs him a breaking ball. It's like 84 miles an hour over the middle of the plate, and our guy hits it 390 feet. Moonshot. And you could see, going back to what we were just talking about presence, but also tying it into not just controlling the controllables, but measuring yourself off of the controllables.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're in baseball, this happens. In hockey, it happens. Hockey, you put a shot top shelf, keeper just makes a great save. That doesn't take away from the quality of your shot. That just is, the guy just happened to be better than me in that moment.
Mm-hmm.
for that pitcher, he made a pitch that 90% of the hitters in the league we were in, and probably a lot of the minor league guys, if they're not laying off of it, and they're swinging and missing at it. 90% of the time, he just threw it to one guy who was going to put it out over in the left field. And he gave up two runs off of that because he got pulled from the game. And I don't think he took the bus home with the team that week because he had himself a bad series on top of that. Mm-hmm. And he just lost all composure because of something that was out of his control.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than judging success off of what he put. You make a good pitch and a guy makes a better swing, tip your cap.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to beat you the next time. Rather than getting soaked up into this idea that I failed because you made a really good swing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. No.
Okay, well, Joe. That's a whole tangent I can go on forever.
Joe, really appreciate you taking the time to come on the podcast today. Like I jokingly said at the start, it's been a long time coming, but I appreciate it nonetheless. What are some ways that maybe some of the listeners could connect with you, whether it be over social media, email, you name it?
So my social media is @_mentaljoe for my Instagram, I believe, and @mentaljoe_ for Twitter. I will make sure Taylor puts them in the description for the Apple Podcasts or the Spotify links because they're slightly different. And my email is on both of those. So if anybody wants to get a hold of me, I'm always answering my email. And feel free to always reach out. I love working with teams. I love talking to people who are passionate about this subject. And why I got in the field, it's why Taylor is someone who I've really grown really close to. And something that if you're a young practitioner that I would recommend is find yourself someone or multiple people who you can bounce ideas off of,
mm-hmm.
who you can grow along with. Because when I met Taylor 2 years ago now, I didn't realize he was a second-year undergrad student. He was just someone who wanted to grow and learn. And we've grown and we've helped each other learn. He's challenged me and made me better. From what he's told me, I've made him better. I don't quite know if I have. But having a circle of people that can make you better is something that will help you grow immensely in this field. Find the good people. Find people that you like and grow with each other.
Mm-hmm.
Enjoy, everybody. Thank you for listening.
Appreciate the kind words, Joe. So that wraps it up for episode 37 of the Mental Dive podcast. As always, I really, really do appreciate everybody's support with my podcast. And as well, I really appreciate it if you could check me out on social media too. Check me out Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, Taylor Staden, that's TaylorStaden, where I share a bunch of clips and different kinds of content around the mental side of the game. But nonetheless, everyone, have a fantastic rest of your day, and I can't wait to share another podcast with you soon. Have a good one, everybody.